KALW.
So let's get as many artists into these spaces who are ready to be a part of a community.
Today, we visit a space that supports artists by providing a place to show their art.
Before I started working with Renee at the drawing room, I don't think I really even considered myself a visual artist.
Artists building connection. Then, sometimes it takes a fresh approach to preserve the past.
I think there's something special about being a teenager that deserves knowing about the past and how people were. You have to learn about your past in order to figure out who you are.
And a teenage author talks old Hollywood.
So I think film is actually a really important part of being a teenager. It helps build your identity.
It's a new episode of Book It. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba and this is Cross Currents. KALW's event space in downtown San Francisco is showcasing work from more than a dozen artists. They're part of a collective called The Drawing Room. And a big part of what founder and director Renee DiCarlo does there is inspire and empower young people. Last week, we hosted a live town hall event bringing together Renee and several other artists that she works with, Arnav Singh, Quincy Fong Adams, and Ananda Fordstrom. Here's the event host, KALW executive producer Ben Trefney.
So many of the people who are here were part of the understudy program. Can you tell us about this program that has brought so many young people into this fold?
Absolutely. So much of the drawing room is based on serendipity. When I opened the drawing room, it was just a tiny little studio and little gallery. And these kids just started coming around. Like, I'm not kidding. Like, Ananda. And I've known Ananda since she was in kindergarten. And this person, when she was six, used to have a Ziploc bag of pens and a notebook. And she would carry that with her everywhere. I don't know if she remembers that. I remember that about her. But then when I opened this space, young people came around because, you know, there's a lot of stuff to do when you have space. You know, there's lots of projects. There's cleaning. There's creative things. There's things. They're just drawing. And I think block printing is a process and a medium that I have found to be really universally exciting and inspiring, because kids have this space to learn how to use their hands differently. They learn how to create pattern. They learn how to translate a line drawing into something that's three-dimensional, but also is in reverse. And it's a challenge, but it's also really fulfilling. And so the program started to kind of grow randomly. These kids were not compensated. and then SF Unified, a friend of mine connected me with a visual art department and asked if they needed, they have this work-based learning program and they didn't have any places with art and for these kids to get work experience.
So I'm kind of wondering from your perspectives, what is it about being at the drawing room in whatever different ways? And I'd like to hear actually from each of you, because it's probably different for each of you. Like, what is it that it fills for you? What does it do for you to be there? This is Arnav Singh.
Renee speaks a lot about like art as a very diaristic practice. And I think that's something that she has emphasized for me, is emphasizing the value of the process of making art rather than the final product or like achieving a goal.
Why is that important, do you think?
I think something that she's taught me is that if you're trying to achieve like a specific goal with what you're making, you're never going to actually be able to achieve that. Like, you're always going to want to have done something differently.
All right, so this is Quincy Fong Adams.
I think the biggest part of the drawing room for me was just creating a community. Community's always been really important to me, and I think being at the drawing room and being able to like bring in people and share the mission and also just like tell people what we're doing and like share my passion to people, that was really important for me. And like seeing how people reflect genuine curiosity for what we do at the drawing room has always been like really life-changing for me.
What do you think is that community that's there? Like, what does it feel like to be there to you?
It's, well, I have been at the annexes on Valencia for the most part, and you see like random people in the mission all the time, people from so many different backgrounds, people that might have never had interest in art ever, and then they come in and you get to tell them what you've been doing and like get them to be involved and like teach them a little bit about what we're doing and like how we share art.
And how about you, Ananda? So Ananda Fordstrom.
I think I've learned a lot about, well, I've met people that I never would have met otherwise, and just learned a lot about art in general. I always kind of thought it was something you had to be able to see just like right away, like, oh, that's art. But I've learned that you can kind of find it everywhere. Like even today we were on the way here and Renee kept putting out like stuff on buildings and like how cool it was, even just stuff like that. So I've learned a lot about how it's just everywhere.
What were some of the things that you noticed on the way here?
There was one building that just had this really like cool design on the outside, and like the ways that they reflected the light, things like that.
Oh, that's such a great way to see the world. So what is the community, what does it mean to you to be a part of this community or to be in this space or to work there or to create or to help in whatever way? Like, what is it that drives you, that comes to your mind about the drawing room? Well, so Renee, yes, go ahead. Please do.
I just want to say about that, all these things, like, I think what I have noticed is that we don't see each other anymore. And I talk about this a lot with people that come through the galleries, and that we have siloed ourselves. We've disconnected from one another. For young people, it is so easy to completely isolate yourself, put your hood up, put your headphones in, put your glass, you know, just get in your zone. You know, you look wherever you go, people are in their own bubble. And as we go forward, we have to create space where people can sit across the table from one another and see each other, because until we see who we are, each other, and our differences and our similarities, we're not going to understand each other. Like, we're just not. And we got to start making change right now.
Those were the voices of The Drawing Room founder and director Renee DiCarlo and understudy participants Ananda Fordstrom, Quincy Fong Adams, and Arnav Singh. They spoke with KLW executive producer Ben Trefney. The artists of The Drawing Room are exhibiting their work at KLW's downtown San Francisco gallery right now, so come over and check it out at 220 Montgomery. All the information is at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Next, it's Book It, our weekly look at Bay Area books and authors. Today, we'll continue to hear from young people about their take on art and culture. Angie Coiro's guest this week is introducing a new generation of viewers to old Hollywood.
Yeah, Hannah, and the reason she can do that so well is because she is a teenager herself. Simone Elias is 15 years old. Her new book is Old Films, Young Eyes, a teenage take on Hollywood's golden age. And this is as far from an academic tome as it gets. It's a blog-style invitation to young adults to pay attention to something important, endangered, and fun. So what was her own introduction to classic films like?
Well, at first, it was hard to get into the slowness at the beginning of the movies. So the characters would be introduced, and I would sort of be wondering, why isn't there any action yet? And I didn't get into like 30 minutes later where it would get much more fascinating. So I had to learn and train myself to sort of sit there and watch it until it got amazing. But at the beginning, I was kind of like, why would anybody really want to watch these anymore? They're kind of outdated and I don't like them anyway. But I definitely changed my perspective on that.
Why did you write this book for people your age? You could have chosen to write a book about old movies for this, if I may say, the standard audience, those of us who've been in them for decades and were decades older than you. And instead, you aimed it at your own age. Why is that?
Because I think there's something special about being a teenager that deserves knowing about the past and how people were. You have to learn about your past in order to figure out who you are. So I think film is actually a really important part of being a teenager. It helps build your identity. And, you know, I see so many reflections in today's pop culture and classic films. The Taylor Swift song, Clara Bow, all these films that echo past movies. And I never see anybody in my generation talking about that. And I thought it really needed to be brought to light.
Well, you've gone to the Turner Classic Movies Festival a couple times in LA. And I wonder, how many younger people are you seeing there?
Not that many.
Mm.
There are some people in their 20s, but it's mostly middle-aged people. And I do love seeing the occasional kid at the festival, but usually if I see a teenager, it's with their grandma, right?
Who may be introducing them to it, which is
kind
of cool.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I did talk about bringing my grandma to a pre-code film, and she said, that was really old. And I was like, huh, that's funny.
You know, it's interesting because I go through the same experience. I'm a silence person, and when I go to the silent film festivals, and I think you share this, it's the fear when you see mostly older people there, it's the fear that this will be lost with them. Those generations die, and God forbid that this whole art could go missing.
Yes, exactly. And I really wanted to bring that to light because it was so eye-opening to see all of these movies and write this book because I sort of realized this is going to die out. And if I don't write this, there was sort of an urgency to it that helped me finish it.
First movie was what?
My first movie was Funny Face with Audrey Hepburn. And I remember getting up and being like, oh, why don't I just dance while Fred Astaire's dancing too? So I got a little workout in while watching that one.
I mean, in the book, you reference the famous Think Pink, which is the opening number in Funny Face. And it's fabulously staged. It is so Hollywood in that it is so colorful. There's beautiful choreography. And I remember the pink silks flying through the air because this is in a fashion house. And I can see why that's a grabber. And that's part of what grabbed you.
1,000%. Yeah. I was sort of like, oh, this is going to be boring, but I'm just going to watch it because I'm the producer on this podcast about classic movies now. And I should probably watch at least one. And then I sort of got really pulled in by the gravity of the dance numbers and the beautiful colors. And I loved Audrey Hepburn. And then I remembered thinking to myself, which I wrote in the book, I guess old movies don't have any plots because Funny Face is sort of just about this model. And there's not much going on there. It's her and Fred Astaire, and she's a model, and they're in Paris. And so I was like, oh, well, they're fun, but they don't have plot. And I was very wrong about that.
I'm glad you saw that.
Yeah, I know.
Now, we got to back up here because you actually were producing or helping to produce a podcast about classic movies before having seen classic movies. How did that happen?
Well, so I actually started as a 10-year-old during the pandemic. I started a quite embarrassing podcast now, but it was called Street Spies. And I used a platform called Anchor.fm, which does not exist anymore. But I was writing scripts about what I saw on the street. So I would say, oh, I saw this today. And here's why you should care about what you see and how you observe. And then I started making other different podcasts. I did one about national parks with my friend. And then so my friend Eliana, she wanted to start this podcast about classic film, and I was already a podcaster, so she brought me on, and I sort of learned as I went along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's just fascinating to me. It's like helping someone talk about something that you're not into yourself.
Exactly, yeah.
I want to note how the tone of the book, because when I first read about it, I anticipated something of almost academic. Here are classic movies, and here's how they work, and here's what the plots are. And instead, it's almost blog-like because you're very much a presence in the book. I had to laugh out loud at one point where you said, you were talking about a certain kind of movie, and you said, And I don't really like those. And I little outburst. I love that. So why did you pick that tone?
Because I wanted to draw in a younger audience. And I know that academic tones have a big presence in a lot of thinkers and readers' lives. But also, the way to draw people in is by being yourself and being authentic and not just stating the facts. I love books that just state the facts because you get what you see. But then I really wanted to add something that brought my perspective to it, because there's so many books about classic film, but none of them are narrated by a teenager and none of them are narrated by me. So I wanted it to be very apparent that it was different. And I wanted to state my honest opinion about some of these films, because not all of them are great.
No, they're not. They're absolutely not. But I think most of them are worthy, even as elements of their time, as pieces of their time, as artifact. I will sit through an old movie, be it an old comedy, a pre-code, whatever, because of the fashions or because of the mentality, or, you know, it's almost like, and you have some of these in the book where you're like, this is not the greatest movie, but look at this. This is worthwhile.
Yeah, often when I watch a classic film, I'll find a little bit of something that will bother me a bit. And then I will find some kind of thing that I learn about the past that it's worth looking past those things for. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time I'll find different treasures in classic movies that I'm really glad I didn't just disregard and throw away.
Mm-hmm.
Just the attitudes, and I get to learn, instead of reading a textbook, I get to watch it, which was really fun. And I learned so much about the past through that.
Mm-hmm.
And also about the not so fun things that happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you distill, when you're watching an old movie, how do you distill what's legitimate history from what's the Hollywood glam version of history?
I know so much about history from the textbooks that I've read in school. So I know that those things were real and actually happened. And then there's the parts where they have huge, big costumes and dance numbers like Fred Astaire. That didn't actually happen, right? But then I also think this sort of became intertwined with these people's actual lives.
Mm.
These scenes actually happened for these people in the theaters, became part of their lives. So why isn't that legitimate?
Yeah.
And it's an important thing to learn about, because it's, movies are an important part of people's lives. And I say this in the book, but when classic films were in black and white, people dreamed in black and white. So that just shows how much movies, the effect that movies have on people's lives. And I also think that even if it wasn't real, quote unquote, real, it still matters and it still had an effect on people.
Yeah. I know that your preferences tend to run toward the lighter things. You like comedies, you like musicals. How did you manage to open yourself up to stuff you may not necessarily like, the noirs and that sort of thing?
Well, I thought of it as sort of anthropology. I was like, I'm going to watch this and see why people like it, why people think it's still relevant. Even if I am not partial to it myself, there's still probably something I can find out of this. So if I don't want to watch Double Indemnity, sit down and watch it, that doesn't mean that it's not a brilliant film.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think a lot of why I like movies is that they're an escape. And so when I see a sad movie, I'm like, but this isn't what I signed up for. It's not the kind of thing that I wanted. I wanted to feel happy while I was watching this. But when I wrote the book, what I was really learning was that an escape doesn't have to be a happy escape. It can teach you about your reality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So let's go ahead and talk about your affection for musicals. You go through a musical, it was Gene Kelly, and you talked about a musical that was not necessarily good, because although it was a musical, which we tend to associate with lightness and comedy, et cetera, it's actually a dark musical.
Yeah, it's Always Fair Weather.
That's the one.
Yes. That, I did a chapter about the satire in 1950s musicals, and that one struck me as different because it wasn't a happy musical. It was a musical that was about the realness of the time and the trauma of post-World War II American life. And I think bringing music into something that isn't necessarily happy, like how they did that in Hairspray, mm-hmm. I thought was really well done. But I think more people should do that because it brings more emotion to it. And I loved talking about that one.
You know, since you bring up Hairspray, it makes me think about your definition of what the golden age was. And it's pretty easy to say, okay, we came out of the silence and there were all the production companies and they were churning stuff out. They were, as you described really well in the book, they were machines and they churned out. And it's a little harder to define when it tapered off and stopped being the golden age. So make your case for when you think it kind of sputtered out.
Yeah, so I have watched a few silent films and I personally don't think those are golden era films, because when we think of a modern film, it's a 90-minute sound film about characters. So I don't count silent films. So when talkies started, I think that's the beginning. Even though when talking films started, they weren't as great as they became, but I think that's definitely when it started. And the 1930s are actually my favorite decade of film, and that's partially because it has pre-Hays Code and post-Hays Code. And then I think the Golden Age actually does end in around 1968, because that's when the Hays Code was finally dismantled and the rating system that we know today was put in action, where they call things R or PG-13. And so that sort of eliminated the problem of the Hays Code. And films obviously became very different in the 1970s. So I think of that as the end, although I still love those.
Yeah, I think you actually drew that pretty well in the book when you were talking about Bonnie and Clyde for one and The Graduate for another. And I think both of those have echoes of old Hollywood, especially Bonnie and Clyde, in terms of the production and the costuming and that sort of thing, but also as a brand new sensibility that hadn't been seen since pre-code.
Yeah, and actually in Bonnie and Clyde, they show a classic film. They show The Gold Diggers of 1933 with Ginger Rogers. And I thought, this really brings it all together. It's when it started and when it ended. And so I thought that really had to be featured in the book. And Bonnie and Clyde actually does take place in the 1930s. So it's a very classic Hollywood style, except for that it echoes a lot of the 60s in it.
I was talking about how you put yourself into the book. I was truly struck by how honest and brave you were when you were talking about the snake pit and about the depictions of mental illness in film. And you're an advocate for mental health based on your own experience. As I read that part, I was just like, wow, that's fantastic. Can you talk a little bit about how mental health and the treatment of mental health were depicted at that time?
Yeah, so I like to talk about Jekyll and Hyde when people talked about mental illness back in the middle of the 20th century. It was very madness. It wasn't inside your head and you seem normal, which is how most mental illness actually is. It was more of the schizophrenic tendency, the crazy manic outbursts. And I think that really stigmatized it. And the way that the film The Snake Pit with Olivia de Havilland shows mental illness is very different. It's not screaming. It's not manic. It's just sad and very depressed. And I thought the depiction of that was just very spot on. And for a film from 1948, it depicted the emotions I felt in that experience very well and very accurately.
You know what surprised me about Olivia de Havilland in that film? I mean, she was a beautiful, beautiful woman. And as you sometimes would see a star do, they strip off the makeup and it's almost like they're kind of slumming. You see that in some, like there's this second reality where they're kind of winking at the audience going, you and I both know I'm gorgeous, but I'm doing this because it's art. I didn't get that from her. I got an artist who was truly exercising her craft. And it didn't matter the way she was gorgeous in other films and whether her makeup was stripped off. She was that person. She depicted mental illness and the slide into it and the climb out of it so well.
Yes, exactly. And what I love about that movie is that it doesn't end in the happy Hollywood way. It's like, this is how recovering from mental disorders actually is. It's up and down, up and down, up and down, and then stabilized, and then up and down again. It didn't end happy. It just ended in the middle.
Yeah, it's progress, it's a process, and they let it be a process. And back then was the era of happy endings.
Exactly. Every romance story has a happy ending. Every Hollywood movie, even today, you can always expect it to end happily. And part of why I love that film is that it doesn't.
That was Book It host Angie Coiro with her guest Simone Elias. Simone's book just hit the shelves this week. It's called Old Films, Young Eyes, a teenage take on Hollywood's golden age. Tune in tomorrow morning at 11. San Francisco is home to some surprising legacies.
There's this magical moment where you can feel they're taking it in. They're hearing again, almost for the first time, oh, I'm valuable. I'm not a bad person. They're getting a different message. We have the opportunity to give people a message that they've never had before.
We'll learn about the oldest suicide hotline in the country and more tomorrow morning at 11. And one more thing before we go. If you have ever wondered what it's like behind the scenes of Cross Currents, well, join us this Friday night. It's Cross Currents Live. I'll be hosting a night of storytelling, poetry, dance, and music. It's a chance to come meet us and experience your favorite Cross Currents features live. Plus, there's pizza from our friends at Joyride Pizza and drinks. Come connect with us at Cross Currents Live. That's this Friday, November 22nd at 220 Montgomery in downtown San Francisco. All the details are at kalw.org/events, and we'll look forward to seeing you there. Today's Cross Currents team includes Demetrius Johnson, Leon Morimoto, Christelle Rahim, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Molly Blair Salier, Shirin Adil, Hani Shaherjani, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Sunni Khalid. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.